AFA founder Brother Don Wildman spent a large portion of his life fighting for the family. He recognized how society was changing, and not in a good way. Ideals and issues that once were forbidden or at least kept private were being accepted and even promoted as normal. There's a danger to playing with sin, and Brother Don illustrated it in one of his episodes of It's My Turn called The Danger of Playing Around. Read about it and listen to that episode when you visit afa.net/thestand.
Welcome to Today's Issues. Join us for the next hour as we offer a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Ed Vitagliano.
And welcome to Today's Issues. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman this week. And I am joined in studio by Chris Woodward. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
And then in Kansas City, KC, Dr. Ray Pritchard. Good morning to you, Ray.
Good morning. How are you, Ed?
I'm doing well. It's just us three. We three. We do have Brent Creeley, our producer, in here, but he doesn't really count. I mean, Brent and I, folks, for those of you going, ooh, that's a terrible thing to say, we kid each other all day long, all day, every day. He's like the brother I never had and never wanted. See, folks, we're just kidding around. Listen, he gets even with me. He slashes my tires. He puts things in my Diet Coke, messes up my cough drops that I put here in an orderly fashion. So, well, that's 2 minutes, folks. You'll never get back again as I discuss my relationship with our producer here. It is Wednesday, May 29th. Mm-hmm. Fred Jackson is doing another show. I think he's doing Walker's show. Later on the day, so we gave him the day off. Steve Jordahl will be on with us at the top of the next hour, as is typical. At the bottom of the hour, we will have Dr. Matt Ayers, who's lead pastor at New Beginnings Methodist Church in Madison, Mississippi. We're going to have Dr. Ayers on because, in light of the killings last week of David and Natalie Lloyd, and also Jude Montes in Haiti, David and Natalie Lloyd are missionaries from the States, young couple. We talked about that yesterday. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Ayers and his family spent many years as missionaries in Haiti. Went on to found a college and a seminary and serve as president there for a while. So we want to talk to Dr. Ayers about Haiti, about the spiritual situation there, about some of the dangers that missionaries there face, just to kind of just talk 10 or 15 minutes, talk to Dr. Ayers to give our listeners a better understanding on the part of someone who has been there. Ray Pritchard, Ray, you have taught in Haiti. So you gave us some insights yesterday into that spiritual situation.
I'm looking forward to talking to Dr. Ayers and get his viewpoint on, some people have said, some people who do not look at the world the way as Christians we do, well, they shouldn't have been there at all. Mm. It was too dangerous. They shouldn't have been there. And that all Christian workers ought to leave Haiti immediately. It's a dangerous place, and it's more dangerous now than in India. I've been there 5 times, but not in the last few years, and it has descended into total chaos.
Yeah.
And this young couple, this Natalie and Davy Lloyd, we can say this much: they knew the dangers,
mm-hmm. right?
And they stayed anyway out of their love for Christ. So I'm looking forward to talking to Dr. Ayers about that and getting his viewpoint.
You know, Ray, and then Chris, we will get here mm-hmm. to the news. But something you said, Ray, just maybe want to just push this just a little bit further. But of course, anyone who's familiar with the Gospels and what Jesus warned his disciples about regarding the dangers that they would face understands this. But you were talking about how the world and people who are not Christian, who are outside the church and the Christian community, don't understand But even from a historical perspective, Christianity, well, we have Christianity in this country because people went where there was spiritual darkness. And Europe was basically Christianized mm-hmm. to a large degree because Christian missionaries would go into places that were under the religious views of the Northmen or whatever, the Anglo-Saxons. Mm-hmm. So this is the way Christianity spread, was Christians understanding the dangers, but for the love they had for Jesus Christ and the people that God also loved, the pagan peoples that Christ also loved, they went into those dangerous situations. And unless you're a Christian, it is hard to imagine why someone would do that.
You know, if you don't know Jesus, it looks like madness. Why in the world, and not just the situation in Haiti, but why in the world would a young couple trained in the U.S., college graduates, smart, why would I know a case of two medical doctors, both of them, husband and wife, medical doctors. I was mm-hmm. their pastor for many years. They super, super well-trained in two of the best medical schools in America. They set aside a very high-paying career at the top of the top to right. go to Nigeria and serve. And their parents had a great difficulty understanding. Why in the world? Aren't there sick people here in America? Yes. Couldn't you stay and help people here in America? Yes. And the only final answer is God has called and we must respond. And the only other thing I want to say, Ed, to your point, Christianity has been from day one a missionary religion.
Right.
We didn't make that up. Mm-hmm. We got
right.
that from our founder,
yes.
the Lord Jesus Christ. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. And it's a simple fact of the 12 original apostles, they all died as martyrs spreading the gospel throughout the Roman Empire. And the only possible exception is the apostle John, who ended up in on the island of Patmos in
right.
prison. The founders, Jesus, the head of the church, and the apostles upon whom the church is built, they showed us the way. And for 2,000 years, Christians, for better or worse, have been taking the gospel into some very difficult places.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why there's the gospel in Asia, in China, in Africa, in Europe, and here in North America.
Yeah. I want to point people to our Today's Issues Facebook page because I just posted a nice article from our Steve Jordahl. He's doing some continuing coverage of this situation in Haiti that we are discussing today and we've been talking about since last week. Steve interviewed Todd Nettleton, a voice of the martyrs. There's a really nice quote in here from Todd Nettleton and Steve's story, and it says, "Those who go to hard places, those who stay, even as law and order is breaking down to represent Jesus Christ, are heroes." Speaking of those who stay, yesterday, and I've shared this link as well on our Facebook page, yesterday, Jenna Ellis interviewed Missouri State Representative Ben Baker. He is the father of the young lady killed last week and the father-in-law of the young man. And Representative Baker told Jenna yesterday that he became aware of Davey many years ago when Ben Baker was in Bible school, and he had heard that Davey and his sister had been kidnapped as 5-year-old children in Haiti, and they were thankfully returned. No harm was done for them, but the family chose to stay there. Even
yeah.
after their children were kidnapped and they served there, they're still serving there. And as far as it appears, they're not leaving.
Well, and last thing I will say on this is that, and then we'll move on. But,
okay.
That some might consider the death of this young couple a tragedy. And I do not want to make, I am not making light of or being dismissive of the pain and the anguish that the parents certainly must be feeling, mm-hmm. even though they're Christians, all right? I can't imagine outliving my children. That's J.J. Jasper and mm-hmm. Melanie, his wife, they've had to experience that. So believe me, folks, that is a whole separate category of pain and grief. However, for Christians, dying young in the service of Christ is not a tragedy, okay, in the eternal scope of things. It is a tragedy for those who lose mm-hmm. their loved ones. But the Bible makes clear that martyrs are a part of the way by which God paves the road for the progress of the gospel. It's in the book of Revelation where there are martyrs beneath the throne of God. I think of the 1956 martyrdom. I looked it up so I could get all the, and I could remember Jim Elliot, but Jim Elliot, Nate Saint, Ed McCauley, Peter Fleming, Roger Udarian, who were speared to death by the tribesmen of a group in Ecuador, I think, Ray, where they were. That was broadcast around the world. Life magazine had a photo essay. A lot of people sharing the same kind of sentiments as Ray and you, Chris, mm-hmm. are talking about, where people just say, wow, that's how, why? Why do you even do that? But people came to Christ from that tribe, and who knows what God might do even in Haiti over this. And it is tragic, but in God's economy, this is a way in which God frequently brings great goodness, great good and deliverance, healing, and even salvation for people who sometimes are the ones who committed the murderous acts. So, Ray, anything you want to add to that, and then we can move on.
I'm just reminded of the famous words of Tertullian, one of the fathers of the early church. This statement is, I suppose, 1,800 years old. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. It has been so in every generation. So we've been reminded in these recent days of the high cost of the Great Commission. But out of this tragedy, and humanly speaking, you cannot say anything else but right. that it is a tragedy. We don't understand the big picture yet, but out of this tragedy, from the seeds that were sown there in Haiti, there will yet come a beautiful harvest in the plan of God. And God will be glorified in what has happened. And so it's not just true today, Ed and Chris, it has been true for 2,000 years.
And folks, let we who remain behind, I can't help but say these kind of things, folks. I know this is not usually a preaching program, but I do want to encourage those of you who are listening who are Christians, all of us, I remind myself of this, to be bold in the presentation of the gospel. We are not facing, so far in this country, spears like Jim Elliot and his brothers on that beach in Ecuador. We are not facing gangs, murderous gangs, as this young couple, the Lloyds, faced in Haiti. So we can be bold. We don't have to be jerks about it, but we can be bold in the presentation of the gospel be inspired by those who actually do lay down their lives for Christ. So let that be an encouragement to all of us to continue praying for their families, praying for Haiti, and praying for our country and the loved ones we have who do not yet know the Lord. All right. I didn't intend that, but God can use that to encourage people who are listening.
Amen. Chris,
let's go on with the news of the day.
In other news, jurors in Donald Trump's hush money trial are expected to begin deliberations today after receiving instructions from the judge and the factors they may consider as they strive to reach a verdict. This is not only a big story here in the U.S., where at least three of the big television networks are all over it. Even the BBC spent a large amount of time on it just now, although they've moved over to U.S. border news. So this is getting a lot of coverage on both sides of the pond, so to speak. The deliberations follow a marathon day of closing arguments in which a Manhattan prosecutor accused former President Trump of trying to, quote, hoodwink voters in the 2016 presidential election by participating in a so-called hush money scheme meant to stifle embarrassing stories Trump feared would torpedo his campaign. Trump's attorneys, meanwhile, bashed the star witness Michael Cohen yesterday as the, quote, greatest liar of all time. Trump, meanwhile, faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records, charges punishable by up to 4 years in prison. Speaking of those charges, I've got a soundbite here of former Representative and Prosecutor Trey Gowdy of South Carolina. He thinks Trump could actually be convicted of a misdemeanor if the judge allows it. Clip one.
Yeah, it depends on whether or not, it depends on two things, whether or not the judge is really willing to charge it and whether or not the defense is willing to accept it. Keep in mind, this really is a misdemeanor that just put on a tuxedo to look like a felony. Mm-hmm. So if the judge gives the jury the option of the misdemeanor and the jury compromises, and look, juries love to compromise. Instead of being a hung jury, they may say, let's compromise on the misdemeanor. There's zero chance that he will go to jail for the misdemeanor. If he's convicted of 34 felony counts, given the fact that this judge clearly does not like him, and given the fact that the judge may want to send a message that no one is above the law, there is a possibility of an active sentence, custodial sentence, for the former president.
I do want to point out that former President Trump has pleaded not guilty and has repeatedly denied wrongdoing in this case.
Well, Ray, I don't think any of us know how this thing is going to go. And frankly, I don't understand a lot of the legalities of what is about to transpire. I'm looking at an article on Fox News. Jonathan Turley, who is the constitutional law attorney from George Washington Law, I think, and he's a contributor on legal matters, not only on Fox, but frequently writes articles. He's saying that the instructions that the judge has given make it possible for the jury to split and that the judge would then still treat their split rulings as unanimous. I have no idea. Okay. But I am set and do believe that this, that a guilty verdict is what was planned long ago, both in the New York City trial and the other trials that the president is facing, that a guilty verdict is what was intended. I have a hard time believing that this judge, because of all we have covered, is unbiased. I believe this judge has it out for the former president. However, we will have to wait like everybody else, but all this has been going on, I think, is intended to get the felony indictment and conviction that the left has just longed for.
Well, there's a word for this, lawfare, which means right, using the law for some sort of political end. Now, I am even more unqualified to comment on this, on the legal side of it, Ed, than you said you are. I only know what I read and as I followed along. But what's clear about this is the whole thing was set up from the beginning in order to lead the jury to convict President Trump. Understand, this is the first time in American history we've had a president, not a sitting, but a former president. It's never happened to go to a criminal trial. That's never happened. If he's convicted, that's never happened. One could hope, one could imagine, could he be acquitted? Yeah, that's possible. Doesn't seem likely with a Manhattan jury pool, right? Doesn't seem likely. Could there be when one or two simply refuse to go along, and I guess you'd call that what is it when they can't make a decision?
It's a hung jury.
Thank you. A hung jury. That's what I was looking for. Could be a hung jury. And then the state would have to decide if they're going to do this all over again. And certainly that would happen after November. But can you imagine what will happen in America if tonight or tomorrow or the next day, for the first time in American history, not just a former president, but the leading candidate to be elected this November is convicted? There's going to be 80 million people, just thinking of the people we know who voted for Mr. Trump in 2020, 80 million people unbelievably angry. If you want to see a breakdown in trust as bad as it's been, this will almost be the final severing for those 80 million people. Won't believe anything the government says or does.
Well, Jonathan Turley, this is what he said. I want to quote him because I didn't know this was possible. But again, none of us here are lawyers, we'll have to wait and see, and then the lawyers can explain it to us after it happens. But he says that the judge in this trial, quote, said that there is no need, these are the instructions that he gave to the jury, that there is no need to agree on what occurred. The jury can disagree on what the crime was among the three choices. Thus, this means they could split 4-4-4. In other words, four jurors believe he did crime number one, four believe crime number two, four believe crime number three, and the judge will still treat them as unanimous. I have never heard of that kind of thing. Maybe that's an odd quirk in the New York law, but you got to have, you're supposed to have a unanimous verdict. Mm. So you would think you'd have to have 12 jurors, but Jonathan Turley is saying the judge is giving instructions so that you could have four unanimous about one crime, four on another, and then it's a unanimous verdict. This seems so bizarre to me, but I guess we'll have to wait to see what happens. That sounds to me yet another reason to believe that this judge and the way this prosecution was set up was to tilt the field so that President Trump absolutely cannot win. And I guess we'll wait to see. Chris, is there any discussion on how long they expect the jurors to deliberate?
I don't have a ballpark figure, but
I mean, I guess it depends.
Yeah,
it can go for an undetermined length of time. But
I still find it hard to believe, and I've said as much on the show, I still find it hard to believe they found 12 people on planet Earth that are supposedly impartial and have no opinion one way or the other about Donald Trump.
I don't think anybody believes that. I really, there's no way in Manhattan that the former president could get a fair trial.
No.
That's just my opinion, folks. I just think that is taking things at face value, the truth.
You could have it in Manhattan, Kansas, and still have a problem of Donald Trump not getting a fair trial.
Right.
Ray, you know about Manhattan, Kansas.
Well, there's a huge difference.
Yeah. There is.
He's a completely different verdict in Manhattan, Kansas than in Manhattan, New York City.
All right, well, you got anything else connected to this trial?
I don't, but I will say in quick election news, current President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, they're going to make a campaign stop today in Philadelphia, city of brotherly love, in hopes of enticing black voters to stick with them. This campaign, for those not aware, have been losing support in the African-American community or black community due to things like the economy. Black unemployment was much lower under former President Trump when he was in office than it ever has been under Joe Biden and his Vice President Kamala Harris. So they're going to Philadelphia today to try to do that. Do I have time for one clip? Okay, let's do this. It's Philadelphia resident Jameel Jackson, a registered Democrat. He likes what Trump has to say, Biden not so much. Clip four.
It was definitely Trump's message. I think when it comes to Biden's message, it was definitely more of, I remember, I think in Black History Month, he was sitting down with a black father and his two black children, and they were eating fried chicken for Black History Month. And this is one of his ways of reaching out to the black community. And I think there's so many signs of just tokenism. And I also think when I see Trump speak, there's so many instances of where, yes, he might go after Biden for Biden unjustly going after him politically with the government and the legal system. However, he doesn't go after all Democrats and everyone who supports Biden. I think he really is trying to unify the country. Whereas with Biden and other Democrats, they're going after anyone who is Republican, who is MAGA, who wants to see, I guess, more resources used for actual American citizens, including Black Americans.
Ray, let me just ask you this. What do you make? And we're not political scientists either, right? You or I. We're not lawyers. We're not political citizens, political scientists. 30 seconds. Do you think that this has legs, that Trump, quote unquote, has legs in the black and Hispanic communities with some of the support for the Democrats seeming to peel away and move towards Trump? Or do you think this is just pre-summer irritation at the current administration?
I think it has legs, Ed, and I predict that in November, Mr. Trump is going to get a bigger share of the black vote than he did in 2016 or 2020. He's still going to go overwhelmingly Democrat, but there is movement It's something is happening out there for sure.
And it doesn't. I don't know what the percentages have to be in order to make a difference in some of these states where big cities like, you know, like Cleveland in Ohio,
right?
You know, Detroit in Michigan, those kinds of places where it can tip a battleground state to Trump.
Just a few points in Michigan or Pennsylvania could make
right. Pennsylvania, another one. Yep. All right, folks, we are going to take a short break. When we come back, Dr. Matt Ayers will be on to discuss the situation in Haiti and what he thinks the spiritual climate is there. And we'll talk a little bit more about maybe what Christians have to endure when they go overseas. We'll take a short break and be right back. Hope you join us. Why is our society so ravenous to abort babies? According to a former Satanist, the demonic forces have a bloodlust for the innocents and sickly believe their blood sacrifice empowers evil. Make no mistake, we are fighting a spiritual battle as we protect the most innocent among us, babies in their mother's womb. Preborn stands on the front lines of this battle, and their network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, often next to abortion mills, where unspeakable evil takes place every day. Preborn offers God's love and life to protect hurting women and precious preborn babies. And every time a baby is saved, which happens 200 times a day, good conquers evil. Please make your most generous gift to empower good and rescue precious souls. For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound that doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250, baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
And welcome back to Today's Issues. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman this week. I'm joined in studio by Chris Woodward. Dr. Ray Pritchard is with us from Kansas City, Kansas. And we want to welcome another doctor to the program, Dr. Matt Ayers, who's lead pastor at New Beginnings Methodist Church in Madison, Mississippi. Dr. Ayers and his family spent many years as missionaries in Haiti and went on to found a college and seminary and serve there as president. Matt, welcome to Today's Issues.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Matt, we talked earlier in the program. Of course, we talked yesterday about the tragic situation in Haiti where Davy and Natalie Lloyd, as well as Jude Montes, I think he was a local director of a missions group, were murdered by gangs in Haiti. So in the Christian community, at least, that has been a topic of conversation. And we wanted to have you on today to talk about your experiences in Haiti because it is that's kind of a mysterious place for a lot of Christians here in the U.S., located on an island split in half, Hispaniola with the Dominican Republic, which is a functioning country with law and order for the most part, it seems like, and a functioning economy. And yet right across that imaginary line in Haiti is the land of, you know, voodoo dolls and you know, occult activity. That's the way, at least that's the way I have looked at it. Tell us what you remember from being there, maybe what your contacts tell you, current people who currently live in that country. What is the actual spiritual climate of that country?
Yeah, the spiritual climate of Haiti is in some ways different yet similar from even what we experience here in the United States. It's just that the manifestation of evil is a lot less subtle there than it would be in a place like Haiti. In the sense, if you were to, you know, visit a witch doctor's, there's not really an English word for it, court, you would say. It's like his yard area with several hut structures. But if you you were to visit a witch doctor in his place of practice, let's say, you know, it wouldn't be uncommon to see voodoo dolls and human skulls and human blood and remnants of animal sacrifices. And that's a much more visceral engagement of, you know, spiritual warfare that's clearly in your space, where death is very present, and there's a sense of eeriness, especially with the dolls that have been disfigured kind of stuff, versus, you know, I think what is more subtle in our American context, where a lot of the evil that lurks beneath the surface is just not quite as detectable, because part of it's just because it's our culture and we're used to it. But, you know, greed, materialism, consumerism, you know, the idolatry of sports, all that kind of stuff. It's less visceral. It's less visceral. But I think it's really important. Something I really like to point out about Haiti is that Haiti has wonderful, wonderful Christian people. Now, it's a bit redundant. True Christian people are wonderful people. They're filled with the presence of God, the Holy Spirit, redeemed by Jesus. They love God. They love neighbor. But, you know, Haiti gets such a bad rap, a reputation from, you know, the voodoo, and because of the visibleness of the nature of evil in Haiti. But the church there, there's quite a strong church there, and there are some wonderful disciples of Jesus, people who are following the Lord and whose lives, you know, are very, very difficult because of the lack of law and order, and yet they try to be good citizens of their nation. They try to take care of one another. They're generous to one another. They're compassionate towards one another. So there's a very beautiful aspect to the Haitian culture and the Haitian people that doesn't get much attention. So you have both. You've got deep evil, deep Christian as well.
Matt, tell us a little bit about when were you in Haiti? Tell us a little bit about your experiences, you and your family there when you were there in that country.
We were in Haiti from 2007 to 2020. And we arrived there very young, fresh out of undergraduate school, assigned to work at this Bible college. I was, you know, teaching scripture to undergraduate students, and my wife was teaching English and the marketing director there, and, you know, grew into a leadership position. But we lived on campus, you know, with the students. And so it was always a situation where we were living very, very much in community with our Haitian brethren. You know, we weren't living in this isolated compound with just, you know, missionaries. Who kind of a lot of mission compounds function like an embassy, you know, where you have all your expats living there together, speaking English and all that. But we lived right with our students and our staff, shared most of our meals with students and staff. My kids would be out playing soccer with the Haitian students and climbing mango trees and picking avocados and all that kind of stuff. You know, for the most part, our life, I try to explain to people, difference between a standard of living and a quality of life. So the standard of living in the U.S. is very, very high. You know, indoor plumbing, electricity, cellular access, internet accessibility. We have postal service, police officers, lights to organize traffic. We have millions of choices at the grocery store, pharmacies, you know, places to eat out, lots and lots of options. So the standard of living is very high. We're very comfortable people with all our creature comforts met. But oftentimes our quality of life is abysmal, even though the standard of living is high. We're lonely, we're frustrated, we're angry. People are addicted to all sorts of substances. And where in Haiti, it's the inverse, where the standard of living is quite low. Very hard to find indoor plumbing. Not many people have electricity. Cellular access is getting better, but, you know, there's armed guards at the gas station. If the gas station has gas today, you know, you've got to have a guard at your compound. So the standard of living is low, but the quality of life is very high in Haiti in a lot of ways. Obviously not every way, but for us, you know, it was hard. We had to run generators for electricity and pump our own water, and we had to, you know, pasteurize our own milk, and had to, you know, go a long way to get good grocery products. Like the standard was very hard. A lot of work just to live. But the quality of life was so good because we were surrounded by people who we loved. It was people-oriented. It was sitting down under the mango tree, sharing coconuts and grilled beef and long conversations and laughter and tears. And so that the relationship that's built around a people-oriented culture versus a task or project-oriented culture, which is common in warm culture climates versus cold culture climates, it means for a rich life and deep relationships. You know, suicide is like unheard of in Haiti. Like, well, why? If the standard of living is so low, why are people aren't killing themselves? Because their creature comforts aren't their top priority. Their top priority is their relationships with one another. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. Ray, go ahead.
Matt, Ray Pritchard here. Let's get down to the case of what happened just a few days ago. We have this young couple, Davy and Natalie Lloyd, who I think from what I've read would agree with your assessment of life in Haiti, both the difficult side and the open hearts of the people. And the story as it has come out, the details are not just tragic and in some ways horrific, not even some things we wouldn't even repeat here on the radio because they're so difficult. Would you say a word? They were in Port-au-Prince, one of the most dangerous places in the world at this moment. How could this have happened? And what I mean is there appears to be no government to speak of in Haiti at the present time. So would you comment on what happened and how things could have devolved so terribly in the capital city that a tragedy like what happened to Davy and Natalie Lloyd, how did that happen?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer because I think the situation is so complex. And anywhere you go, I mean, why things are the way that they are, it's really, really risky to be oversimplistic and to be reductionistic and reduce things down to X and Y. I would say that, you know, the primary reason why there's lawlessness and I wouldn't call it anarchy, but just a lack of government, a lack of law in the land in Haiti, it boils down to culture. It just boils down to culture. And, you know, I think that culture is determined and defined by all sorts of different factors and variables, but one of the main things that determines that is our belief system, our worldviews, the things that we understand to be true. And, you know, in a place like Haiti, it's African culture, even though it's in the Caribbean, because it's made up 99% of the population have a heritage of African, you know, roots. And what comes with that is animism, which is the worldview of animism, which means that every object is animated or attached to or associated with, that's a better word, associated with some sort of unseen spirit, whether that's an animate object or an inanimate object. So there's a spirit of the bush. There's a spirit associated with the tree or so inanimate objects. But there's also spirits associated with animate objects. Like there's a spirit of the goat and there's a spirit of the cow. And there's a spirit of course, people then. And there's spirits of even governments and there's spirits of communities. And so animism, this idea, this very primitive idea that there are spirits and behind every living thing. Well, that's a very scary world to live in. Even if the spirits, according to the animistic worldview, are benevolent, out for your good. You know, they want you to be healed. They want to help you. But they're also malevolent spirits that want to hurt you, that are seeking your harm. And so it creates very much this culture of fear. And we know that operating out of place of constant fear, fear of the unknown, fear of why things happen the way that they do, a lack of control over our environment and external circumstances, that just is a perfect soup to create a very dysfunctional context. And so when people are operating out of fear all the time, what happens is it compounds the issue of like this, you know, being I for one, of course, Christian, I have a Christian worldview, and I understand from the doctrine of original sin that we're all narcissists. We're all bent inward upon ourselves. And there's no part of us that hasn't been affected by this issue of sin and selfishness. And so you compound that with ongoing fear and a complete inability to understand or control the external world. Well, that's going to make you turn on yourself yet even more. And so you multiply that out over a nation of 10 million people. Oh, that's a scary thing. You know, you get someone into a position of power in government, And they're going to want to hoard up and store wealth and not relinquish power, and therefore, you know, do whatever it takes to maintain power and to accumulate wealth. And that means corruption, and that means, you know, dishonesty. And so it's just these, I think it's that principle. I think it has everything to do with culture and being dominated by a spirit of fear.
Our guest has been Dr. Matt Ayers, who's lead pastor at New Beginnings Methodist Church in Madison, Mississippi. He and his family spent many years as missionaries in Haiti and went on to found a college and seminary and serve as president there. Matt, thank you so much for these insights, and they were very insightful. Your views about, I especially appreciated the distinction between more explicit evil and the implicit evil that you have in many developed Western countries, including our own. That's something for Christians to keep in mind. But anyway, thank you so much. We appreciate you here at American Family Association, American Family Radio. You've written some good things as well, and we appreciate your insights here on this tragedy in Haiti, and also the statement about the strong church in that country is an encouragement for us, and kind of eye-opening, too, to hear that the church is a very bright light in that country. So thank you so much, Dr. Ayers, for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right. Hey, Ray, I did find that very interesting conversation with Dr. Matt Ayers, and he is right. You know, I was clear about how I saw Haiti just really from media. I've never been to the country. You've been there five times. But when talking about the emphasis on death and the demonic, when he was describing some of those things, skulls and that kind of thing, I thought, you know what? You can go to just about any concert in America in the rock and context of rock and roll. And I'm not even talking about going back to Madonna, even some of the current artists, and see that same kind of demonic emphasis. And that is a little bit more behind the scenes than when you'd have in Haiti, but it's just as evil.
You know, it was said to me when, on more than one occasion when we visited Haiti, the country is, it has a very large Roman Catholic population. It has a smaller but growing evangelical, conservative, Protestant church population. And it was said to me something like this, you know, Haiti is what, 80% Roman Catholic and 20% Protestant and 100% voodoo. That is to say, it's so deep. Yeah. It's so, as Matt said, it is so deep in the mindset of the people. And even in the good church, good evangelical churches that I would minister with and to there in Haiti, they had church members who still had the amulets and still had the signs and markers of voodoo. They had brought that with them into the Christian church, and sometimes it takes quite a few years for them to let go of all that. And I did read the other day that since Haiti has descended into the kind of chaos that it's a gang. Port-au-Prince is run by gangs, criminal, godless gangs are running Port-au-Prince, that in the midst of all this chaos, voodoo is on the rise again in Haiti. Why? Because I think, as Matt Ayers said, it's a fear-based culture.
Right.
So when chaos breaks out around you, you go back to the amulets. You go back to the witch doctors. They're doing bigger business now because people don't know where else to turn. Another reason for us to pray for that country and for there's a strong evangelical movement in Haiti, and we ought to be praying for them. Yeah. I've got the last thing I want to say, just 2 weeks ago in Little Rock, I was in a 40th anniversary banquet for Hosean International Ministries, the folks we work with in Haiti, up in the northern part. And this we were at that banquet about 4 or 5 days before the tragedy happened with Davy and Natalie Lloyd. And the leaders of that ministry, who are dear friends of ours, have since gone back to Cap Haitien, which is up on the northern coast of Haiti. And Marlene and I every day are praying for Caleb and Debbie for their safety.
Yeah.
We must pray for our brothers and sisters Haiti, because it's a dangerous place to be right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, even if your church does not support an American missionary in Haiti, odds are your church or a church near you does support a national pastor there. There's a number of organizations now that have been created and funded to help reach national pastors, to train them up so that way they can reach people in their own country with their own language. So, you know, while you may not have a Davy or Natalie Lloyd, so to speak, serving in Haiti for your church, you probably do support somebody over there that is a local that's from Haiti. So do be in prayer for that person as well.
All right, Chris, next story.
Yes, from time to time on this here program, we bring in exchanges between America's frenemies, Peter Ducey and Karine Jean-Pierre. And that love affair continued yesterday between these two. Peter Ducey asked Karine Jean-Pierre about a Politico article, which was published yesterday, claiming the Biden administration and the Biden campaign is in freakout mode over his reelection chances. Hardly a day, an hour goes by without hearing a story about how Biden is hurting in the polls. He's losing this person.
Politico's not a conservative source of information.
It is not. It is not Fox News. It is not Newsmax or OAN by any stretch of the imagination. So for Politico to say, the Biden administration is in freakout mode, somebody close to Joe Biden and the campaign went on the record and told them as much. So Peter Ducey asked Karine Jean-Pierre about that yesterday. And keep in mind, there are rules and regulations that somebody, let's say the press secretary, can't talk about campaign issues. And that would be the same thing for a Republican. But Peter Ducey did ask her about that. And listen to what she has to say here. Clip 7.
Are you guys here at the White House in full-blown freakout mode?
What are you talking about?
There's a Politico story. It sounds like Democrats outside, the quote is, Biden's stubbornly poor polling and the stakes of the election are creating the freakout.
So, again, I'm going to be mindful. I'm not going to comment on 2024 election. I will say this. The president has never forgotten where he came from, who he is. He understands what the American people are going through as they're sitting around the kitchen table. You hear the president talk about his time growing up, where he watched his family having to sit around the kitchen table, making incredibly difficult decisions. And the president has always said he's going to fight for communities that have been forgotten. And you see that in the policies, economic policies that he's put forward. He's going to continue to fight for the middle class. He's going to continue to fight in every way that he can. You heard me at the beginning talk about junk fees, incredibly important. And he's going to continue to fight and to make sure that corporation greed doesn't continue to take hold. That is something that he's been very clear about. While Republicans are doing the opposite, they put out a policy where they want to give a big tax break to the wealthiest among us, billionaires and corporations. That's not what the president wants to do.
Three things there. Number one, she's not going to comment on campaign issues, but she went into full campaign mode. Two, she continues to throw out this thing that they're doing things to get rid of junk fees. I'll get back to that in just a second. And three, they continue to blame corporate greed. They say and have said for weeks now that the reason you're still paying high prices is because your grocery store is greedy and they want to keep charging high prices to make money off you. Even Chuck Schumer the other day blamed big oil for high gas prices when policies overseen by this administration are partly responsible for why we're still paying more for gas today than we were this time last year. The junk fees thing is something that they've been pushing for a while now, and they did get rid of junk fees. These are these like added fees that you get at credit card bills and stuff like that. That's great, and we all welcome it, but that's not going to help make more money at the end of the month for people, so to speak. That's why the economy is still an issue, and that's why, bringing us back to the issue of them having to go to Philadelphia today, that's why this administration is losing support amongst people of color, including Hispanics, which favor Trump out west in Nevada over over Joe Biden.
Ray, I got to say, listening to that, and that was a little bit of an extended clip from Karine Jean-Pierre, but I question the wisdom of answering questions about the president and repeating the phrase, the president will not forget, has not forgotten. because that to me that I know that's a little snarky, but everyone thinks the president does forget stuff.
And look, it's not really that snarky, Ed. I mean, every day, not once a week, Ed, but every day we see a new clip of our befuddled president standing there looking vacantly around, waiting for somebody to tell him what to do, somebody to point him, go this way. No, Mr. President, don't step there. You'll step off the platform and so on. So I don't see how snarky it could be to just point out the obvious. Our president, the leader of the free world, the commander-in-chief, is befuddled and confused, evidently, most of the time. And I don't think he can remember what he has already forgotten.
Yes. Listen, I will say this on behalf of the president. I do think there is some price gouging going. I've said that on the show before. Tim accuses me of hating capitalism. I do not. Capitalism is awesome. It is a powerful engine for bringing people out of poverty, entire cultures. Okay. But I do think there's some price gouging going on. However, having said that, the president is getting blamed, rightfully so, for the inflation that is happening, for the downturn in the economy, for the poor employment news that we get all the time. Mm-hmm. And that is because of his policies. So while corporate greed may be a partial explanation for what people are paying at the grocery store, it is not the whole story. And in any case, it's irrelevant because the president, in the minds of increasing numbers of voters, is to blame. And that perception is what is endangering the Biden reelection. And we said on this show, presidents get too much blame when things are bad, too much credit when things are good. But that's the way it is. President Biden, you wanted the job. Mm-hmm. All right, 5-minute break for news, and we will be right back.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.